Up next, Yang Rui, who hosts the program Dialogue on China's global television network, takes a look at the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution.
In 1917, the October Revolution overturned the centuries of feudalism in Russia, established the world's first communist country, and inspired a revolutionary spirit in people around the globe. 100 years on, what does the October Revolution mean for the world today? How did it impact China's own revolution and social development? While the collapse of the Soviet Union marked a triumph of capitalism, 10 years of recovery from the financial crisis have seen renewed interest in Karl Marx's influential book, Capital. Is capitalism being challenged today? What are the alternatives? To discuss these issues and more, I'm happy to be joined in the studio by Mr. Zhou Shuchun, Editor-in-Chief of China Daily. That's our topic. This is Dialogue. I'm Yang Rui. Welcome to Dialogue. The October Revolution occurred 100 years ago, so we're going to mark the 100th anniversary. But many who observed the process of October Revolution pointed out that this major event of last century was actually a mistake and at least premature. Do you agree?
Absolutely not. The revolution is a product of the given special circumstances of the time. It's no accident, no mistake, no premature birth, or no slip of pen by the God, as some people put it. It's something inevitable. It just happened. History has a rule of itself. Hypothesis doesn't work with history, especially not with a kind of hindsight perspective.
So what do you think of the impact and significance of the October Revolution?
I think it's up to the Russian people to make the assessment. We can't speak for them. And I suppose it's something for them to brood over for a long time to come. But from an outsider point of view, and to take a long-range kind of historical outlook, probably we can draw some parallel. Nowadays, we talk about the miracle of China. Wasn't there a kind of a Soviet miracle back then? The country rose to power, rose to the status of one of the two superpowers of the world, the only one to challenge, to counterweight, to compete and match with the United States. And the Soviet Union was the backbone against the Nazis in the Second World War. So what would have been the outcome of the war if this revolution never happened? So it's kind of a historic, it's epoch-making, and history is to be respected.
With the end of the Cold War in 1991 and the disintegration of the Soviet Union accordingly, there came a wave of re-examining history. Francisco Fukuyama, a political scientist from the United States, wrote a book called The Last Man and the End of History,
right,
announcing the triumph of Western capitalism. What do you make of his theory on the so-called post-ideological world order? What does that mean for the rebuilding of a triumphant China which vows to rejuvenate the dream of being a great China?
I think there is no end to history. If the idea of the end of history theory is for socialism to fade out of history, it didn't happen. As a matter of fact, Mr. Francis Fukuyama revised his theory. He said something to the effect afterwards. The end of history seemed to have been postponed. And later on, he said that Western democracy might not be the end of the evolution of human history. So there have been revisits to the theory, and this, as you said, as you put it correctly, has something to do with the success of China. The story of China, the Chinese experience shows that there is the possibility of modernization with a different approach, like in a form of socialism with Chinese characteristics. This shows Western democracy is not the answer for all countries seeking a path of modernization.
What do you think of the relationship between China's revolution and the October Revolution?
As we often said, it's the October Revolution, or rather to put it more vividly, it's the cannons or band of the cannons from the Aurora cruiser that brought Marxism to China. China might have stumbled or stepped upon the right path of development, but there is a clear, direct link between the October Revolution and the Chinese Revolution. And I think that is the beginning, the starting point of this long protracted process to make Marxism Chinese. Yes? And China of today has traveled thus far, arriving where it is from that particular point in history.
From October Revolution to the collapse of the Soviet Union, the 20th century may have witnessed a war between socialism and capitalism. It seems that capitalism has taken the upper hand. How do you assess the development of capitalism?
First of all, I'm not sure whether the 20th century is a century of socialism versus capitalism, but it can be called a century of war and the revolution. And this reminds me of the book written by Eric Hobsbawm with the title The Age of Extremes, A Short History of the 20th Century. And in the book he asked 12 people to give what he called a bird's eye view of the 20th century. One of them is Ehud Menuhin, the violinist. I'm not sure whether what he has in mind, what he had in mind when he said this, but this is the best I've read of as conclusion of the 20th century. And he said, if I had to sum up the 20th century, it raised the greatest hopes ever conceived by humanity and destroyed all illusions and ideals. As for the development of capitalism, I think, to quote Marx, Karl Marx, on one hand, capitalism or the bourgeoisie shouldered the responsibility of creating a new basis, new material basis for a new world. So it could have been something of an unconscious tool of history, unconscious tool of historical progress. But on the other hand, it's like a magician who cannot control the devils he conjured up from the magic box or bottle, like the financial crisis. It's something capitalism is not ready to deal with.
In the immediate aftermath of the Cold War, a late president of the Russian Federation, Mr. Boris Yeltsin, learned a lot from the advice from America introducing the shock therapy. Russia seems to be still struggling with the aftermath and consequences of the shock therapy, whilst China has made rapid progress in and transformed its economy into the second biggest one. What do you make of the gradualist approach of the Chinese road in modernizing both its economy and society compared with the devastating consequences that beset the Russian Federation up till today?
We don't have to make simplistic comparisons between the two countries or different approaches to develop the economy. But anyway, China is doing very good or far better compared with the rest of the world It shows that China has chosen the correct path suitable for its own conditions, national conditions, realities of China. And this is the best we have learned from history. We don't jump on conclusions, we don't adopt a textbook approach or copy anybody else. We just explore our own way of modernization.
The core issue concerning China's gradualist approach in modernizing our own economy, I'm afraid, is not to radically privatize the economy. We have adopted a mixture of both public ownership and private ownership. Look at the reform of the SOE, state-owned enterprise. What can you tell about the this formidable part of our economy, and do you think there is still a strong relevance for the SOE to be an integral part of the Chinese economy?
It's part of the idea of public ownership, which is the backbone of the economy as a whole. But behind that is the Chinese way of doing things. It's the beauty of the Chinese culture to learn all the, to absorb all the best elements learned from different parts of the world, all parts of the world. For example, people used to say that to combine market economy with socialism is like to have bamboo grafted on a tree, saying it wouldn't work. But it's well done in China.
Yeah, it seems a renowned economist Li Yifu quite agrees with you about combining the two, a planned economy with the strong elements of the market economy. But the point is why European Union and the United States still refuse to grant China the market economic status. But you are watching Dialogue with Mr. Zhou Shuchun, Editor-in-Chief of China Daily. We'll be back in a short while. Stay with us, please. Welcome back, Mr. Zhou. People like Francisco Fukuyama, whom we discussed earlier in the first part of the show, seem to reach a consensus that unless and until we are able to combine with the liberal democracy with the liberal market economy, the economy of China, or indeed in other developing countries, won't be a big success. However, look at what happened 10 years ago, the financial crisis in Wall Street.
Right.
An article of Financial Times a couple of weeks back said, well, the failure of Soviet communism, which was initiated 100 years ago, seemed to join hand with the collapse of liberal neoliberalism that is characterized by market economy in the West. Isn't a coincidence. So what do you think of the commemoration of these two major events in the context of setbacks of communism of last century? What do you make of the financial crisis that we witnessed 10 years ago in the United States?
I think it's a good idea to draw a parallel between the two events, the October Revolution and the financial crisis. They are both events of the most important events of the century, or centuries respectively. They are like kind of two thick books to be read and reread from time to time, and debates to be played from time to time, despite the passage of times. People won't have absolute consensus about the events. For example, the financial crisis, people learn from the crisis. For example, as a part of the discussion about how to build a better world, we have to re-examine some of the essential relations, like in the case of the financial crisis, the virtual economy versus the real economy, the market versus the government, or rather the invisible hand versus the visible head, and equality versus efficiency, or rather the rich few versus the poor many. And probably Keynesianism versus neoliberalism, and in a broader sense, probably socialism versus capitalism. We have to re-examine the whole set of theories.
Whatever the ideological differences between Soviet Union and the United States, we are looking at the relationship between the government and the market. Today, it seems we still enjoy a very strong central government as opposed to the visible hand of the market economy. So, may I just go back very quickly to the refusal by both the European Union and the United States to accept China as a full-fledged market economic status. Today, China wants to go its own way by not giving up the central planning. So what do you think of the industrial policy of the Chinese authorities in navigating our own course independently as compared with, say, the financial derivatives and the free market economy in the West? And this free market economy wreaked havoc with the world back in 2007, the financial meltdown, of course.
I think if there is any kind of consensus about as to why the financial crisis happened, took place at all, people largely agree it's the bankruptcy of neoliberalism, which is the culprit, I think, for the financial crisis. And I can quote a headline from one of the American newspapers, I think, saying that we are all Chinese, meaning Chinese practice, kind of elements of socialism were introduced to deal with the financial crisis. And there was analysis that President George W. Bush would be remembered as the American president to have introduced socialism to Wall Street, the stronghold of capitalism. So what can you say? I think we have to adapt to the new realities of the world. It's not just black and white. We have to learn from the painful experiences to reform people's theories or set textbook theories.
What do you make of the basic hallmarks of capitalism and market economy? Is it about rule of law, level playing field, what else?
In terms of economics, I think it depends on where you stand. In terms of economics, I think it's free market, of course, and at the same time, it's production driven by capital seeking to expand constantly in this regard of the limitation of consumption on the part of consumption on the part of the masses. It's kind of overproduction versus limited consumption, if I can say that.
Mr. Zhou, in the wake of the global financial crisis, Karl Marx's book Capital staged a comeback in public imagination. Are people finding explanations in this book, which was first published 150 years ago?
As Francis Wynne, the British, renowned British journalist, author of Da Capital, a biography, said, Karl Marx was never buried under the rubble of the Berlin Wall. He is very much alive, and his relevance is only beginning to be felt. And he could be the most influential thinker of the 21st century. And if you read Economics by Paul Samuelson, he quoted another philosopher of Britain, that is Isaiah Berlin. And he said, no thinker of the 19th century has had so direct, so deliberate, and so powerful an influence on mankind as Karl Marx. So it shows the relevance of the book and the thinker.
President Xi Jinping said over and over that China is increasingly confident in providing a Chinese solution to a humanity's search of better social institutions. What's your understanding of China's solution?
Probably on this point, we can go back to the October Revolution. I think what China is doing, the Chinese Revolution, China's reform and opening, have been part of those efforts to build a better society. And today, we are doing better than most of the countries. I think shows that the system behind this miracle of China is very telling to the world. We are doing great, and we are doing great not for some wrong reason. And the success, the story of China's success, could not sustain without a good system.
Yes. We have our own problems, and of course we solve our own problems and we navigate our own course in front of a watchful world audience, most of which are not quite sure as to whether we're going to succeed eventually. But do you think the so-called China model can be copied elsewhere around the world?
First of all, I think since the adoption of socialism, dating back 100 years with the October Revolution, 97 years with the birth of the Communist Party of China, 68 years with the founding of New China, and 39 years with the reform and opening, the idea, the theory, has transformed fundamentally and profoundly the nation, the destiny of the nation and the country. But however, I think China is not seeking to impose its own values, beliefs, system, practice upon other people. China is always ready to learn from other people. I think that is really exactly the secret of the success of China. That is the country's ability to learn, learning abilities. That's what we call a learning-inclined party, a learning-inclined society, a learning-inclined country, the most reliable and effective foundation and weapon for facing up to the challenges of the world.
5 years ago, President Xi Jinping, when he first took office, raised the slogan of ushering the China dream and rejuvenating the right. Chinese civilization. He also went further to put forward the idea of building a community of a common destiny. Mm-hmm. The core part of this concept, I'm afraid, is the introduction of a co-prosperity and to be inclusive in constructing the Belt and Road Initiative. Exactly. What do you think of the feasibility?
On the one hand, I think globalization constitutes the kind of cradle for this community of common fate, common destiny for mankind. The new material basis is out there, out of the process of globalization. So it's not the wishful thinking on the part of China. On the other hand, I think it's in the genes of the Chinese culture, the Chinese civilization, to build a world of harmony. And today, China is the second largest economy of the world. Is considered more responsible for the well-being of the world, and it's time for China to share more of its ideas, solutions, plans for building a better world.
Perhaps it's a golden age, it's great times for redistribution of wealth and assets right. throughout the world in what we call the implementation of the Belt and Road Initiative. The last question is very much about the rivalry, if any, between capitalism and communism, because many scholars want to be a prophet in outlining what's going to happen next in the age of globalization. But by the end of the day, we would find ourselves repeating the same question concerning the competition between different ideologies with communism and Western capitalism being the key players in the arena.
As I refer to the kind of anecdote about President Bush being remembered as the one to introduce socialism to Wall Street, the argument served to say that there could be competition going on. But I think as far as China is concerned, China will only mind its own business, focusing on things of its own, and it's not seeking to bring about the destruction of other people. Rather, instead, we seek to develop, we seek common development. It's the Chinese belief to help others achieve and establish what oneself hopes to achieve and establish. So I'm afraid, I think, we are not seeing a world of clash between different sets of theories. Instead, it's going to be a world where different culture, different schools of thoughts, different systems exist and develop at the same time.
Well, ironically, you have praised President Bush Jr. twice throughout the half an hour show. But he's the guy who tends to look at things in black and white terms. Actually, we live in a world which is not governed by the zero-sum game. That's perhaps the crucial point of what Mr. Zhou Shuqun said in his analysis about the contrast and comparison between communism and Westernism when we commemorate the 100th anniversary of the October Revolution and the 10th anniversary of the financial meltdown. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.
UK's Prime Minister Theresa May has had a tough job since she came into office. Her biggest challenge, Brexit, which explains the title, the Brexit Prime Minister. And to this day, this has plagued her administration. In this edition of The Debate, we'll discuss where Brexit stands when it comes to the negotiations with the EU. This is while May will come under pressure from business leaders to speed up negotiations with the European Union. Press TV's Amina Taylor joins us from London. She's been following Brexit developments to tell us about two major developments happening. Well, you got the deadline that's looming, you got this letter. If you can tell us what and how those two stand.
Well, what an absolutely disastrous week for the Prime Minister, and it's just kicking off. I mean, we're right on the tail of the resignation, quote, sacking of Priti Patel, and of course, Mrs. May losing her defense secretary, only to wake up this morning to news that Boris Johnson, her arch rival, and a man we thought was his arch rival, one Mr. Michael Gove, had actually sent a private letter to Mrs. May's private secretary and the Prime Minister to say, listen, things with Brexit aren't going as quickly as we would like, and pretty much can you move stuff along? Now, this was not supposed to be seen by the public. It's in fact been leaked. So we now know that not only is Mrs. May under considerable pressure from those who are looking tomorrow during this new vote on the EU withdrawal bill to actually gain some concessions for the Remainers, but she's under strict policy deadline issues and deadlock issues within her own cabinet. I mean, if the Prime Minister doesn't get a handle on this, she's going to look incredibly weak to people like Michel Barnier, who's, of course, leading those EU negotiations. And then very briefly, we, of course, have David Davis, the European Brexit Secretary, today, just within an hour or so, saying that there will be a final vote for parliamentarians on Brexit. So will this mean Brexit will be blocked? Does this mean that Brexit will be dragged out? Because part of this letter, Carvey, that Gove and Johnson put together, they talked about not having this transition deal go over 2021. So I think the Remainers and the hardline Brexiteers are locked in battle right now. And perhaps tomorrow, when that EU deal is renegotiated in Parliament and we have a vote, we'll see which side is winning.
Very well. Thank you for that. We appreciate it. I mean, it's other, of course, one of their talking to us from London. Let's get some analysis on this. Investigative journalist Tony Gosselin joins us from Wiltshire in the UK, and writer and lecturer Jonathan Fryer joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. Jonathan Fryer, I'd like to start with you. Theresa May in negotiations with the European Union for quite some time at this point. Well, maybe not so much time. I mean, we're talking since June. Is she getting a fair shake on this? I mean, is she doing well or not? Of course, we can't just say her in particular. You also have Davis, who's leading the negotiations.
Indeed, it is David Davis who's at the head of negotiations. And although he's been trying to give a very optimistic pitch about the way things are going, there is increasing frustration and indeed confusion in Brussels, not only by Michel Barnier, the chief EU negotiator, but by the other 27 member states who believe that Britain still has not made clear exactly what it wants. And of course, there are still three major outstanding issues: the financial divorce bill, it's being called, the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and other things which mean that basically no future deal can be agreed until all that is settled.
Well, let's see. Tony Gosling, our guest there, says the UK has not made clear what it wants. Is that really accurate? I mean, they must have said a few things of what they may want, but altogether to say that it's not clear what it wants, do you see it that way?
This letter that we've had leaked, I think, is fascinating, as it shows that actually many of the politicians here in Britain are much more interested in their own political fights within the Conservative Party than they are about actually making a good deal for Britain. Looking at this strategic leak, I would say that's what it is. It's not just some sort of accidental bit of information that's got out. I would even suggest that Boris Johnson and Michael Gove are behind that leak, because they actually want Theresa May out of the way. And I would suggest that's actually quite a good thing. At this important time for Britain, I mean, because we are really leading many people across Europe away from Brussels. There's a very powerful move for people to just get disentangled from the European Union. We need to have a strong government. We haven't got a strong government. We've got an extremely weak government. Theresa May's got no political authority whatsoever. She's got her ministers running rings around her, and she's also not in a position of ever having been elected into the post. So I think, you know, actually, it might be a good idea for her to just get out of the way and to allow the 120,000 or so members of the Conservative Party to select the leader that they want, not the leader that was put in charge of the party after Cameron left, by what many insiders I've spoken to say effectively are the securocrats. That is to say, the secret services in Britain and the political operators behind the scenes wanted Theresa May in that job, and that's why she's there. She's clearly not up to the task. And if we're going to have a Brexit which is good for the UK, she needs to go.
Okay. Well, do you agree, Jonathan Fryer, with that? I mean, we have had Theresa May's government plagued by two high-profile resignations, and of course, with reports indicating 40 MPs have agreed to sign a letter of no confidence.
Indeed, yes. And I mean, although Tony and I are coming at this from very different perspectives about where we see things are going, where we maybe hope things are going, I think we're both agreed that indeed Theresa May has been horrendously weakened by the splits within her own parliamentary party, indeed within her own cabinet. There's behind the scenes warfare between various ministers, with on one side, for example, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, who was a strong remainer in the EU referendum last year and who is arguing for the so-called soft Brexit, which would mean that we would not have a cliff edge departure or a no deal departure, whereas others, including Messrs. Johnson and Gove earlier mentioned, are basically saying, well, we should really play it hardball, and if we don't get a deal that we want, and they haven't yet quite defined what they want, then we should walk away. So, as I say, Tony and I have very different views on this, but we agree Theresa May is a dead duck. But there's nobody obvious to replace her.
Well, Tony Gosling, first of all, let's talk about what seems to be in black and white, or maybe it's not, but it seems to be something that the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has said from the get-go, and it's this divorce bill. And now he said up to 80 billion euros. I think the figure 60 billion euros is maybe up for discussion here. How important is this divorce bill on the rest of the process? I mean, is it all or nothing when it comes to it?
Well, actually, the divorce bill, in a way, is a way of kind of spiking the negotiations, I think, from the EU insisting on this money. I would suggest, actually, there needn't be any divorce bill at all. It needs to be a severance of an agreement, but that doesn't mean to say that one side or the other has to pay anything. What's happening is also, I noticed this week, that Angela Merkel in Germany has said that that the Germans will make up the shortfall when Britain leaves of the money that the British used to pay in. So I would have thought that that the Germans could pay that divorce bill if the British decide not to. I think we've got to be realistic about what is Brussels and what is going to happen with this negotiation. I don't think that Barnier, for a start, is in any way accountable to the democratic structures of Brussels. That is to say, he's not accountable to the European Parliament, he's accountable to the Commission, which are just appointees. So effectively, he's got complete freedom to say what he wants. No one is saying to him, no, you can't say that, you can't say that, you must do this, you must do that. It's not actually, no lines of accountability with Barnier. So what he's doing is he's playing extreme hardball. I think actually there's also behind all this, there are extremely powerful movements in other parts of Europe that want to secede from Brussels. And so you've got Barnier trying to make sure that Britain gets punished as much as possible for choosing to leave the European Union. And it sets an example for others around Europe to dissuade them from doing the same. And so he's going to make things as difficult as he possibly can. That's why he's who he is, and he's not democratically accountable. And it says a lot about the way that the European Union is run, I think, about the accountability of it. You've got effectively, I suppose the British on the one hand, I mean, our Conservative government is similar in some ways, but it makes a distinction between whether the political leaders in Brussels are actually serving the public of Europe. Let's remember, 800 million people that they are in some way governing in Brussels. Are they our servants doing what we want? Or are they a bunch of control freaks? And I'm afraid they are effectively running cartels across the continent. And they are, I think, the latter rather than the former. And this attitude to negotiation proves what I say. They actually are punishing Britain. They don't actually want...
Uh-huh. So now we're getting somewhere. Okay. Jonathan Fryer, so punishing the UK at the expense of costing Prime Minister Theresa May maybe her job, would that be good for the EU? Or bad, if that's the case?
Well, I have to say I don't accept the premise of any of Tony's recent arguments. For the first point, which is a point of fact, Michel Barnier has the very difficult task of trying to get agreement amongst the 27 other governments of the 27 member states as to what exactly they want to get out of the EU deal with Britain after Brexit, if Brexit actually happens. But there is no question that Brussels is trying to punish Britain. That is nonsense. It is a very, for the EU, obviously, extremely inconvenient that Brexit is going ahead, because it means that so many of the programmes which the British are already signed up to are now under threat because of Britain leaving, but more importantly because the whole of EU politics, like British politics, is dominated by this Brexit issue, which is infecting virtually every sector of political and economic debate. And all the other EU states, in various different degrees, are very disturbed by the possibilities of what Brexit may mean, particularly if it is a no-deal Brexit and we follow Boris Johnson's famous line of not giving a farthing, in other words, a tiny bit of money to the EU. And let's also say on that divorce bill, you know, it's a rather bad phrase for it, because actually this is money that Britain already committed to pay for EU programmes which are going to roll out over the next couple of years. So in other words, it's living up to commitments, which is why Theresa May, and one good thing to her credit, is she accepts that and she said, yes, Britain is an honourable nation and we will live up to our commitments.
Well, Tony Gosling, when you talk about the fact that the EU is punishing the UK, I think at the end there you said that because ultimately, if I'm correct in understanding you, that maybe the EU does not want the UK to actually leave. Is that what the EU is pushing for?
I think they are thinking, you see, that our European leaders, mostly as whether or not they are protecting the behalf of the people in Britain. Now, they may not like what the Britons did, but they may not like what Catalonia decided recently to leave Spain. But what they should be doing is upholding people's democratic rights. And I mean, if they had done a better job in running the economy,
Okay, unfortunately, I gotta jump in. We're just not having a good audio connection. Jonathan Fryer, we have to talk about businesses. They are asking for reassurances. And what they're looking at in terms of the reassurances, that's what is somewhat in question here. What is it that exactly they want?
Well, the main thing that they're asking for is that we should be able to stay within the European single market. In other words, continue the situation we have at present, which is that British businesses can sell without tariffs and other barriers to the other 27 member states and vice versa, which is terribly important. Now, at the core of this, of course, is the so-called transitional period, which could be 2 years or maybe longer. Indeed, many businesses in Britain are saying 2 years isn't long enough. We can't adjust in 2 years from a change of circumstances to moving to being outside of the single market. And indeed, British businesses, of course, have been amongst the most vociferous campaigners who hope, and it is a hope, albeit not a very perhaps realistic one, that Brexit will prove to be so impossible that it won't happen and we will stay in the EU after all.
Tony Gosling, the reassurances that the businesses want is focused on, first and foremost, on this transitional progress or transitional phase. What is exactly this transitional phase that they want reassurances on?
Well, you know what, personally, I'm not interested in what businesses want. Businesses have had what they want from the European Union for decades now, and look where it's left us. In Britain, we've got over 1 million people now, families, that is, using food banks. We're being told that the migrants who are coming to Britain, working here, are doing us a favour. Actually, what it's meant is that lots of British people, millions of British people, have been decanted out of those jobs, and they're labour has been undercut, sometimes only people prepared to come to Britain and work for just half what the British people were working for. And so, you know, we have got a disaster in the economy, as I was saying, in the euro-dollar zone. We had the 2008 bailouts, which in my mind was the end of capitalism. Once we've got banks that are bankrupt being propped up by the government, we've got socialism for the super rich. And the amounts of money that are being spent on this war on terror, we just heard this week, didn't we? I think it was in the Wall Street Journal that the cost is $5.6 trillion for the war on terror. What's happening is all of this money that's being created is going towards war. And this is an absolute disaster. They have completely wrecked the European and American economies. And so I think what's going to happen, this is my little prediction, is that once Brexit happens, the economy is going to crash and everybody is going to blame Brexit, at which point I would suggest that most people's money will be sucked up by the governments, that if they've got any money in savings, most of it will go to the governments to pay off these ridiculous debts of these parasitic zombie banks. If I had some savings, which I don't have much in the way of savings, I would put them in Russia, actually, where there's around about 7% interest rates. So I think that's the backstory to all of this, is that we've got a crash looming, and the Brexit is going to be blamed for that crash. Actually, it's inevitable. With or without Brexit, this crash is coming sooner or later.
Okay, well, let's see here. Jonathan Fryer, British officials, they want certainty. You say that they don't know what they want, but they want certainly that the EU will reciprocate and at the same time agree to the outlines of a transition deal. That doesn't sound like what you said about the UK. You said that they don't know exactly what they want. What is it then that they're saying here, based on what I'm looking at, that they want certainty that the EU is going to reciprocate? What do they want the EU to reciprocate? Jonathan Fryer? Tony Goslin, question to you.
What do the European Union want to reciprocate? I think a lot of the time what we're seeing here with the negotiations is a kind of shadow play, really, where the one side, actually I would say the EU is worse than Britain, because David Davis almost seems sometimes like a bit of a rabbit in the headlights. He doesn't realise that what he's dealing with here are people that do just simply want to punish Britain. So when it comes to reciprocation, I'd like to see some from the EU as well. That is to say, we need to have equitable on both sides. So in other words, if Britain was to go to the EU and say, right, well, we want 20 billion euros from you when we leave the EU, I don't think the European Union would take that as a sensible negotiating position. And yet Britain is supposed to take that as a sensible negotiating position. So they're abusing their power, as they have been for the last 30 or 40 years, actually, since the Maastricht Treaty, which turned the EU, which we joined originally as a common market, into this United States of Europe. It's one country, it's a political system that we're now part of, that most people across Europe are now deciding they've had enough of because it's simply not working. And that's because it's not democratic. And we've seen that as a perfect example with Brexit. We've had a democratic vote for the British people to leave, and the way that we've been treated by the Brussels people, I suppose, is what you'd expect from a bunch of control freaks and dictators. Effectively, they're running a cartel, a massive cartel of cartels from Brussels. And they are used to just deciding for themselves what happens. They don't like the idea that anybody, particularly here in Britain, might say, well, we don't want to do it like that. And we've seen, as a result of being in this cartel, most of our industry in Britain over the last 40 years been completely stripped out. We're no longer a manufacturing country. And for example, aircraft industry, car industry, steel industry has all become part of these largely German cartels now.
Well, Jonathan Fryer, Michel Barnier has said that the UK needs to clarify its position. We know that. It actually gave a two-week deadline for the next stage of these Brexit talks. And the question that comes up is that if this doesn't happen from the UK, then it's going to jeopardize the trade talks that are going to kick off in December. Do you think that those trade talks are in jeopardy right now?
Yes, indeed, I think they are. These talks are within the framework of what's called the European Council, which is when the leaders of the EU member states get together and obviously will try to move things forward. But if there isn't a clear indication from Britain exactly what sort of relationship they are looking for, and if they haven't dealt with the outstanding issues, then I think it will be impossible for there to be an agreement in December, and that means that the whole thing will be pushed well into the new year. I would like to pick up one point, though, that Tony mentioned. Obviously, I don't agree with his point of view on this. The reason that that Britain contributes so much to the EU is because a central part of the EU structures and philosophy is that richer countries should transfer resources to poorer countries. And that means so. For example, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and previously Poland received large amounts of money.
I'm sorry, I got to jump in and give Tony Goslin 30 seconds here. Tony Goslin, in closing, you have the floor.
Well, look, it's not just about money, and I'm afraid that's the way that the business people and generally the Blairites and the left of the Labour Party look at this. It's also about quality of life and the amount of money people have got to spend in their pockets at the end of every week. And we're now in a situation in Britain which has been, we've been run by many of the Brussels people for such a long time now, and we just simply need to separate in order to reset our economy so that British people can decide on where people get jobs, because we desperately need decent paid jobs here, and that's not been the case in the last 4 or 5 years.
Thank you for that. Investigative journalist Tony Goslin from Wiltshire, UK, and writer and lecturer Jonathan Fryer from London. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikova Tawain, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
The British Prime Minister has called on Europe to unite against the supposed threat from Russia. In a speech, she accused Moscow of military aggression, election meddling, and spreading fake news.
It is Russia's actions which threaten the international order on which we all depend. So I have a very simple message for Russia. We know what you are doing, and you will not succeed.
The Mansion House speech is an annual event where the Prime Minister traditionally delivers a foreign policy speech. And introducing her today was the Lord Mayor of London. He's sort of like the figurehead for the City of London. And he used the opportunity to remind the Prime Minister that really the City of London is getting pretty nervous about the state of the Brexit talks. And he said that fine words butter no parsnips and the city needs a good deal now. However, the Prime Minister's speech hardly touched upon Brexit at all. Instead, Theresa May focused on the global challenges facing the UK and its allies. And so talk turned very quickly to Russia. Theresa May accused Moscow of seeking to undermine Western values. She used the phrase international rule-based order in relation to Russia violating that system more than once. And she wheeled out a pretty comprehensive list of accusations against Moscow. Take a listen.
Russia has fomented conflict in the Donbass and mounted a sustained campaign of cyber espionage and disruption. This has included meddling in elections and hacking the Danish Ministry of Defence and the Bundestag, among many others. It is seeking to weaponise information, deploying its state-run media organisations to plant fake stories and photoshopped images in an attempt to sow discord in the West and undermine our institutions.
Well, despite all that alleged meddling and hacking, Theresa May's message to Moscow is that it will not succeed, that the UK will do what is necessary to protect its allies.
We are driving reform of NATO, So this vital alliance is better able to deter and counter hostile Russian activity. It is why we have stepped up our military and economic support to Ukraine. It is why we are strengthening our cyber security and looking at how we tighten our financial regimes to ensure the profits of corruption cannot flow from Russia into the UK.
Now, interestingly, after all that tough talk, the Prime Minister then struck a more conciliatory, perhaps a more hopeful note. She said that the government doesn't want to return to the Cold War. She doesn't want to be in a state of perpetual confrontation with Russia either. She said there is another way. That's why the Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, will be travelling to Moscow soon in order to seek dialogue in an attempt to build bridges. But she did issue those pretty robust warnings to Russia. What I think is important is to place this speech into context. Domestically, Theresa May has had a pretty tough start to the week here. There's very little progress in the Brexit talks, so little that it's reported now that the EU's chief negotiator is preparing for the potential outcome of a no-deal scenario, of a collapse in the Brexit talks. And here in London, there's rumours of a plot to oust Theresa May, of a potential vote of no confidence from her own party. And that's not even getting started on what opposition politicians are saying about the way she's been handling this Brexit process. The media's talking about her lack of leadership and her ministers telling her what to do at the same time. So perhaps the one thing that all the squabbling politicians here can agree on is how much of a threat Russia poses.
Now, political analyst Adrian Yaland believes the Russia allegations are a useful distraction for Theresa May.
It was clear that, you know, there were a number of issues she could have talked about. She could have talked about Brexit in more depth. She could have talked about the issues in North Korea with greater clarity. But she chose instead to focus on the issues with Russia. And I think that actually what that does show is that this is a real concern for the West. But I also think that Russia needs to understand that, you know, at this moment in time, Theresa May needs some good news because she hasn't got much good news on the Brexit front. It looks like the European Union and the UK are both preparing for a no deal on the Brexit talk. You know, talking about Russia at this moment in time perhaps is a useful deflection for the Prime Minister to deploy.
We'll be right back. Thank you.